It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Legislative Republicans introduce a proposal to broaden the seclusion and restraint criteria for Wisconsin students to include risk of emotional distress to others. Our state's education department documented thousands of seclusion and restraint incidents in a report issued earlier this year. Call in with a question or comments about managing student behavior. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Meyer is co-director of the Midwest Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports Network that offers school districts a framework for how to proactively prevent and respond to problem behavior in schools. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this measure under consideration by our legislature would allow isolating or restraining students when there is risk of emotional distress to others. And the current statutes, they limit those steps to where there is a risk of physical harm. What is your reaction to the proposed changes?
Thanks for having me on. Thanks for asking that question. I think when I read through the suggested revisions, this seems to be taking some steps backwards in terms of creating a safe environment in schools.
In what way?
The language that I'm seeing would be not just making it easier to use these practices for emotional distress, but also in the phrase considerable disruption to a classroom. So I think what is going to happen is we're going to be putting teachers in a position in the middle of challenging behaviors, to be making clear decisions about what would be the appropriate response. And it seems that when this takes place, teachers are, we're going to see an increased use of restraint and seclusion rather than a decrease.
How do other states regulate isolating or restraining children in schools?
We did a thorough review of states' policies and laws. About 30 or so states do have policies around restraint and seclusion. Most have legislative guidance in place. What we're looking for would be states that have consistent guidance with what the U.S. Department of Education recommends, which is that restraint and seclusion is only used in a crisis situation where there is serious and immediate danger to the individuals.
So very rarely is what you're saying. And it's like the option of last resort.
Absolutely. I feel for those who are probably coming from the perspective of how do we keep our schools safe? Mm-hmm. Parents who want safe schools, teachers who want the tools to create that safe environment. And I think that I can understand that perspective, the thinking of if there's a disrupted environment, could teachers use physical restraint to somehow de-escalate that situation quicker or maybe create a safer environment? That's what I'm assuming is some of the motivation behind this kind of thinking. And the reality is it's probably going to increase the use of those strategies, and it might increase the amount of disruption in the classroom, because in many ways we're going to be responding to the function of the student's behavior. If they're looking for adult attention, for example, for teacher attention, if acting out is their method of communicating, then the physical restraint, the use of seclusion, may actually reinforce and continue that behavior.
Talking with Brian Meyer at the Midwest Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports Network as we look at seclusion and restraint in Wisconsin schools. You can join in with your comments, your questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian, our State Department of Public Instruction started collecting reports from schools about the use of seclusion and restraint in the 2019-2020 academic year. How useful is this reporting?
I noticed that as well. I think that's wonderful. I'm glad that DPI is doing that. I took a quick look at the data, and the report was showing that about 80% of the students who were restrained or secluded, or the instances maybe were students with disabilities. And so what was interesting to me is that's pretty consistent with what we found for other states that report as well, that students with disabilities are disproportionately represented in these numbers. So I applaud DPI and the state for gathering that data. And I also think they're doing a nice job of analyzing it and then asking the questions, how can we reduce the use of these harmful, dangerous practices?
Children with disabilities, what about children who have experienced trauma? Can you glean anything there from the figures?
That's a really good point to make. One of the things that we hypothesize is that the experience of restraint and seclusion itself can be traumatizing. And so I think in some ways, this notion of how do we support students who have experienced trauma is to create the safest and most welcoming classroom environment we can. And when we engage in these practices, we're presuming that we're adding to the trauma of students or introducing new traumas to students. It's a very stressful situation when you're engaged in either of these practices. And I can speak to that from personal experience. So in some ways, if we want to be trauma-informed, it's best that we think about our work in terms of prevention, using a framework like positive behavior intervention and supports to predict and prevent disruptive behavior. And the less disruptive behavior we have, the less crisis we're going to have where there is immediate danger to others.
Let's take a call now. Rachel is joining us from Appleton. Rachel, hi, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a special ed teacher in Appleton, and this is kind of crazy to hear that they would think about changing this, the things that you would do seclusion and restraint for, just because right now it's for imminent danger of themselves or others, but if it's just due to a classroom disruption, that's just going to traumatize kids more. The use of seclusion and restraint does cause trauma for students, so we really should be using it as an absolute last resort. Plus, if it's in a classroom, just because they're disruptive, other students are going to be traumatized from seeing it.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing. And Brian, mm-hmm. what do you make of that observation from a special education teacher?
Well, I appreciate the voice of special education teachers and all teachers. I think Rachel makes a sound point. The experience itself can be traumatizing. I was thinking about the individual student. The very nature of that act can be traumatizing and informative to others around them as well. I think I want to add to Rachel's point of this can also be very traumatic for the adults involved. A crisis is, when the adults don't know what to do. And once we get to a point where we as adults have decided to put our hands on students and prevent their movement, we're introducing risk. We're introducing physical danger. There have been deaths associated with these practices. So I think Rachel is asking the right question, and maybe with someone with her experience, she's even advocating for using tools that we know that works, that reduces these practices and creates better behavior.
And we're going to get into those tools with Brian Meyer, co-director of the Midwest Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports Network, based in Illinois, partnering with states like Wisconsin to promote positive school culture. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the use of seclusion and restraint in Wisconsin schools as the state legislature considers a proposal to expand criteria for the practices. call in with a question, share thoughts, email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Meyer leads the Midwest Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports Network that works with schools on ways to proactively prevent and deal with conflicts. Let's go to Denise in Madison. Denise, hello.
Hi. I was just, you know, I agree with your first caller so much. I think that it should absolutely be our last resort when we're restraining. I guess I do want to point out, I'm a special education teacher. I've probably in the past 10 years done minimal restraint like twice in 10 years. But sometimes we have students who are truly harming themselves. They're pounding their head on the floor. They're, you know, there's all these things that we see that it truly is protective of kids. And so I just hope that people understand that special ed kids are not just, at least, you know, when I look at my own school, they're not being restrained because they're disrupting class or it's usually because there's something really pretty traumatic happening.
Denise, thank you so much for bringing that to the conversation. Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, what I think I'm hearing from Denise is that the current guidance in the state of Wisconsin is allowing Denise to create a safe environment for the students that she has. And if she's had to engage in a restraint a couple times because of the immediate danger that the student is posing to themselves, she has done that. And it sounds like that has not disrupted then the rest of her classroom for the 10 years that she was talking about.
If a student is experiencing a crisis and being disruptive or harming themselves, as Denise mm-hmm. was talking about, how should teachers respond?
You know, I think the most important message for all of this is that the work is done in prevention. And that it's about organizing the school so that teachers don't feel like they're alone in trying to figure out what are the best practices that they should be using. So the best guidance is have your school work together on something like positive behavior intervention and supports. And what you're going to be implementing would be clear expectations for the school, for the students and the staff, and then clear instruction on what are we teaching the students in terms of skills to help with emotional regulation. If we can teach those skills during neutral times, then that empowers teachers to use that instruction as students are becoming agitated. The prevention work is so critical to reducing the frequency and the intensity of those acting out behaviors.
I want to ask you specifically about a cool down space or a break space mm-hmm. where that student could go and how that environment of a cool down space differs from like seclusion.
Great. Yeah. Great question. I think sometimes folks tend to mingle the two and they might create what they're going to call a cool down space, but it acts like seclusion. When I think about it simply, seclusion is when you're going to prevent the movement of a student. You're putting them in a confined space. Mm-hmm. A cool down space that the student is given as a resource, the opportunity to assign themselves to with maybe some sensory tools to help regulate. That could be a useful strategy. To make it effective, we have to be instructional about that space. So what that might look like would be having all of your students use that space as a station rotation during their school experiences, where they're interacting with those sensory resources or they're working on maintaining a calm pulse. If we do those during neutral times, we're building a skill set so that when they're needed during stressful times, they can be more effective.
And then in your research, you say in crisis, fewer words might be better. Like, I'm here for you when you're mm-hmm. ready mm-hmm. and the name of the child. Why mm-hmm. might fewer words be more appropriate?
Well, I think the big idea is that when there is a crisis, when there is an immediate and present danger, we want to help the adults in the setting with having their routines be practiced, be consistent, and be as simple as possible. The adults are going to have heightened emotions as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be stressed out. And so how can we keep things simple for the adults? So my experience, an example of what that might look like is a student is engaging in dangerous behavior. We're going to make sure there's a safety plan in place for the space. And that's going to be a plan that's predetermined by the school for classrooms. The teacher or the assigned adult is then going to be present with a student in a safe physical presence and might be giving really simple, clear instruction. Right now, I'd like for you to put your hands at your side. Or acknowledging some praise. Great job staying in the room. Let's have it. Please take a seat. And you're going to keep it simple, and you're going to avoid the content and the context. You don't want to get into a power struggle with students. Some type of routine like that, like a 1-2 statement, helps the adult keep calm and keep clear, prevents them from getting pulled into power struggles, and lets the student know that there's an adult here that is going to be present, is going to help keep them safe, and is going to de-escalate rather than escalate the situation.
Brian Meyer at the Midwest Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports Network, as we look at seclusion and restraint in Wisconsin schools. You can join the conversation. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Troy in Muskego is here. Troy, hi, go ahead.
Hello, good morning. I just want to say that, you know, there are children that are, you know, I'm an inner city teacher and I've been doing this for years. And I just want to say that there is a difference between children that are emotionally disturbed, and a lot of teachers are using all these modern practices, calming corners, all these things, and they are effective and they do reduce it. But however, the surge and the uptick is actually not, I feel a lot of the kids that are emotional, they have like a, they've got an IEP or they're, you know, there's services, because the teachers usually, there's a program and the teachers know about it. This is what we do when this kid does this. What it really is you have an uptick in kids having tantrums, and that's from the parenting. And these kids are coming to school and they're having tantrums on a regular basis. And the schools are doing everything they can in their power to work with the parent and work with the kid. And, you know, this kid just happens to have a tantrum in your classroom and now he's walking around. And those kids will mess with other kids and they will create a sense of, you know, they're giving these kids PTSD. I mean, these kids are in class. Okay, go ahead.
That's okay. Troy, I wanted to jump in here and allow Brian to respond too. A couple things I think that you bring up here, Troy, is the connection with parents and guardians and what that relationship looks like when these things mm-hmm. happen. And then the role of the IEP, the Individualized Education Plan, in you know, precedent and in how to interact with children who have these types of situations.
Yeah, I think Troy's perspective is one that I think is heard often, which is, where are the behaviors coming from? Where are they starting from? And then what do they look like in the school setting? And sometimes we might use language like tantrum, for example. But at the end of the day, it's acting out behavior. And it's likely, perhaps, that behavior is also occurring outside of the school setting. And so if we have students who are acting out in school, and we know that this is also happening in the home setting, that's where something like PBIS can help us look at a multi-tiered approach to individualizing supports for that student and helping teach skills that can be transferred then to the home setting.
Oh, so that there is consistency at school and in home and environments. And so that too becomes very consistent across the child's day.
It is. We talk about the work in terms of tiers. And what are we doing for all of the students? What are we, how do we increase supports for groups that need certain skills, like maybe anxiety or acting out behaviors? And then for intensive needs, how do we individualize some supports on top of that? And when mm-hmm. we're getting to that tier three, parents should be a part of the process all along, but it's going to be critical that we're talking about that family voice and how do we help that student be successful in all of their domains.
In our final moments together, about a minute, Congress, group of lawmakers advocating to ban the use of seclusion and restraint in schools, the legislation co-sponsored by U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. How is Congress approaching this issue?
So there has been proposed federal legislation for more than 10 years that would make the federal law more consistent with what's currently in place in the state of Wisconsin. It might go a little bit further in terms of even more prevention in terms of seclusion. But it's really trying to get consistency that we're going to treat students with dignity and prevent the use of restraint and seclusion except for immediate danger and risk.
Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Meyer is co-director of the Midwest Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports Network. It's based in Illinois. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the United Nations Climate Summit kicks off, we connect with Wisconsin researchers presenting during the two-week Global Climate Talks. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a pro athlete who recently moved back to Wisconsin.
Janelle McCarville's WNBA career included plenty of highlights, including a championship in 2013. The 6'2" center also played internationally in Italy, China, and Sweden. Her playing career came to an end in 2022, but then she returned to her hometown in Wisconsin. She wound up coaching high school girls basketball in Stevens Point and is now living in the same house she grew up in. WPR's Rob Menser talked with McCarville about her life as a pro athlete.
Bring it in and let's get going, all right?
Knockout 3, 1, 2, 3, smash!
My name is Janelle McCarville. I am the head coach of the Stevens Point Area Senior High Girls Basketball Team. This is my first year as head coach. I have played professionally in the WNBA for 9 years. I've played overseas for 15 years with numerous championships in numerous countries.
Here we go, next group!
I grew up in Custer, Wisconsin. Two bars and a post office. Went to Stevens Point High School. I had so much support from the family and cousins that I don't think I would have made it without them. But I was a farm kid, you know, so like it was just action on the farm, playing with the brothers. I enjoyed soccer, so the U.S. Olympic team had won the World Cup. I remember where I was when they won it. I think Brandi Chastain hit the penalty kick, took her shirt off, waved it around her head. You know, first time female had ever done that. It was almost, you know, indecent exposure for certain people at the time. But oh my God, as a young female athlete, that was my role model right there. The U.S. Olympic team, soccer team.
Bring it back!
Basketball is the last thing I picked up, truly. I really only started in 7th or 8th grade. You know, if you were into something, you had to be into it because mom had to sacrifice all the time to drive you to town, waste, you know, 2 hours waiting for you in town. So we really had to buckle down.
Set it back up with whoever drove and whoever was behind.
Then went to University of Minnesota. I was the only person that year as a freshman. They only recruited me. I dominated. I won freshman of the year in the Big Ten. And from that year on, we never had a losing season in Minnesota.
McCarville, one-on-one, goes right around the corner and lays it in.
That's big time. I mean, this young woman has been the best player in the NCAA tournament. She has been sensational.
The WNBA was there, but not so popular or well-known. A European basketball career was never even thought of. You know, I didn't know anything of it. So I was just hoping I could, you know, continue because for the love of the game. Going into the draft, I didn't know anything. So me and my family, mother and father, went to New York to be in the draft. And draft day, you know, I'm just sitting in the room with everybody else, and all of a sudden they call your name. And it just so happened I was number one. I was taken to Charlotte, the Charlotte Sting.
Comes up with, look at this
play.
Oh,
my goodness. Janelle McCarville, that'll be the best play she makes all season long.
And probably the best play that we'll see all day today.
Yep. Everything grew as I got older. I just learned. I improved mind, body, and soul as to what needed to happen, and it created habits. You know, 21 days makes a habit, and you do these things long enough, it just becomes part of your life. And I guess that's where I am today and why I've been so successful is I dove headfirst and gave everything my best.
Ready? Go!
We won the WNBA championship in 2013 with the Minnesota Lynx. It was one of the most trying years of my life, actually. coaches push you to the brink, and this year it was the beginning of that. I don't know. You have your lifelong dream of winning a championship, and the only thing I did, partied with the girls and went back to the room and watched film. You know, I was like ready to do it all over again. I'm not satisfied with just this one. So then, you know, already thinking about next year and taking the other one and the preparation that's needed for it. So it's hard to live in the moment.
Hello, everybody. Please have a seat. Welcome to the White House, and give it up for our special guest, the Minnesota Lynx. Hey.
So I got to go meet Barack Obama. You know, he shook my hand and said, "Oh, Janelle, I love your passes." You know, like, holy shit, the President of the United States knows my name and knows what I excel at. You know, like, that's crazy to me. Like, then again, it hits home, like, wow, I've come a long way and done a lot of things, and basketball has truly provided all of it.
WPR's Rob Menser brought us that story on basketball player and coach Janelle McCarville, a Wisconsin native. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lolan Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The annual global climate talks are underway in United Arab Emirates. We hear from a delegation from Wisconsin presenting at the conference known as COP28. And you can join in with your questions and comments about climate change, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nova Tebbi is a doctoral student in UW-Madison's Environment and Resources Program, studying how to make climate policies healthier and more equitable. Nova, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and Dr. Jonathan Patz is here as well, professor in the Nelson Institute and Department of Population Health Sciences. For 15 years, Patz served as lead author for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Patz, welcome back.
Kate, it's a pleasure to be with you again. Thank you.
So scientists have announced 2023 will be the hottest year in recorded history. You've been involved with the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for years. Does this conference in Dubai feel more urgent than past conferences?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we've seen records breaking all over the world regarding heat waves. We've experienced the wildfires. And for the first time ever, the Earth's temperature rose above 2 degrees centigrade average last week. So things are becoming quite concerning, and there's a lot on the line in this conference of the parties this year to turn things around and to reduce our emissions from burning fossil fuels.
Nova, why should Wisconsin residents pay attention to these climate conferences when they're happening a world away from us?
Well, you know, the conferences may be happening a world away, but the effects of climate change can be felt every day in normal life. Mm. Wisconsin, you know, with the wildfires and the smoke in the U.S., lots of flooding that's happened. Those are all extreme weather events that come from climate change. And fossil fuel combustion, like coal and natural gas and oil, creates air pollution. And we've saw a lot of air pollution issues in the U.S. as well. So even though these conferences are happening a world away, we can definitely feel the effects of climate change. And so what happens at the conferences in terms of climate action can benefit Wisconsin, can benefit the U.S. and everybody living in the world.
Dr. Patz, there's something that happens at these conferences called global stocktake. Can you explain what that is and then how it will unfold at the climate talks?
Kate, I would love to do that, except that Nova led our submission to the global stocktake. So I'm going to pass that in just a second, because it's really it's the first time ever that the Conference of the Parties has asked for us to take stock in the progress we've made since the major 2015 Paris Agreement. What I will say, and I hope Nova will chime in on the global stocktake, is that in its 28 years of COP meetings, this is the very first time ever that there's been a full day dedicated to human health. So that's something that is major. And of course, that's that's the area that we come in looking at health and climate change. But I'll pass the global stock take question over to Nova.
Yes, take it away, Nova.
Sure. Yeah. So the global stock take, for people who don't know, is essentially what I would call the report card of the Paris Agreement. We're trying to see how well that agreement has held up. And are we on track to reach the goal to limit warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, if not 1.5? And so at COP28, the goal is to have somewhat of a text come out showing what progress has been made since Paris, where there are still gaps in action, and some guidance and way forward as we head to 2030, 2035, et cetera. And so this text and what is in it hopefully will tell us where parties stand in the fight for climate action, but we'll just have to wait to see till the end of COP28 what will happen.
Are there tensions around these types of reporting and report cards as countries view what has happened since Paris?
Yeah, I would say there are a couple contentious issues, particularly in the global stock take. One of those is talking about what progress has been made. Mm-hmm. We definitely want to acknowledge and have a positive, you know, language on what has been done. But there's a lot of debate on what the guidance and way forward should be. Should it be prescriptive policy? Should we tell countries, you know, what emission targets to aim for? Or should they be more nationally determined based on their context in, you know, developing their economy, et cetera? So there's a lot of different issues and disagreement.
And explain what you submitted as part of the global stock take.
Sure. So what was great about the global stock take is it not only took statements from countries and parties, but it also opened it up to civil society. And that is where we submitted. And in our submission, we really outline the progress that's been made in terms of climate action that's benefiting health and equity. So what we would call health co-benefits. So for example, if we phase out fossil fuels, we can improve air pollution. And so the co-benefit there being we can improve the environment and we can also improve our health. So our submission outlined some of the great progress that has been made globally on these types of policies.
Dr. Patz, go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, if I can just add, you know, regarding the air pollution issue, you know, when you burn fossil fuels, not only does it emit greenhouse gases that are heating the planet, but you're emitting, you know, you're polluting the air, and that's hazardous. A breaking new study came out 2 days ago from the British Medical Journal by some of the best air pollution epidemiologists in the world, showing that fossil fuel related air pollution, so from burning coal and oil, that air pollution kills 5.1 million people every year, and this is track back to fossil fuel-related air pollution, which is about 60% of all air pollution. So it shows how, you know, getting away from fossil fuels can really make a difference in saving lives. And the Global Climate and Health Alliance, which is a group that we submitted the global stock take with, has called for a fossil fuel phase out. That's a lot. A lot of countries are asking for that. That's where there's some contention when you've got some of the oil-rich countries, you know, worried about this issue. But this is something that is really being called for by health organizations. In fact, 46 million health professionals are represented in a call for a fossil fuel phase out as soon as possible.
Coming to us from Dubai at the UN Climate Talks, Dr. Jonathan Paths, researcher at the intersection of climate and health, and is at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute professor. Nova Tebbe, UW-Madison doctoral student in the Environment and Resources Program. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Member support is the single largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. More than 50,000 donors make the daily news, talk, music, and entertainment possible.
Thank you so much for your generosity.
Thank you.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you so much.
We are so grateful.
Thank you for your generosity.
Your support of WPR informs and inspires Wisconsin.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The United Nations expects more than 70,000 delegates at COP28, the annual global climate summit underway in Dubai. We hear from two Wisconsin researchers presenting at the talks. Dr. Jonathan Paths is here, professor in the Nelson Institute and Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison. Nova Tebbe is a doctoral student in UW-Madison's Environment and Resources Program. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nova, official negotiations happen in a restricted part of the global summit. In another section, you have academics and organizations, NGOs, business groups interacting. How productive is the less formal part of the conference in fighting climate change?
Great question. I think academics, organizations, they have a lot of what's called pavilions within the same zone that negotiations happen. But in these pavilions, there's a lot of presentations that happen. There's a lot of good dialogue that happens. So even though that's not necessarily important for negotiations, so to speak, it's really important to meet other people, hear other ideas, and talk about what progress is being made in certain parts of the world that you may not have heard before. So there's still some benefit, especially just in terms of knowing more.
Dr. Paths, President Joe Biden not attending this year's UN Climate Conference. What role should the United States be taking on the issue of climate change?
Yes. Well, of course, the United States historically has been the number one emitter of greenhouse gases. We are no longer, but over the last 60 years, we have been. So U.S. leadership is pivotal for progress to happen. I think the meeting that Biden had with the premier of China just last week was very important. So I think that Biden, you know, stepping forward and that meeting with China is a huge signal. And so we're seeing, Vice President Kamala Harris is here and John Kerry, of course. So there's major leadership from the U.S. and the meeting that between U.S. and China was essential that it happened. I think his not being here is not that big of a, you know, it's not so big of a problem because the U.S. and China did have a very important meeting and we have high levels. We have senators that are here. So I think definitely the U.S. has to lead and be part of this issue.
You know, as we look at fossil fuels, Nova, there you are in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, oil-producing country, part of OPEC. Could the location affect any actions the U.N. conference considers or agrees on?
Potentially. I think it having being set in Dubai, it's right there. It's right outside the conference center. We can see this infrastructure happening. Whether or not that's going to lead to urgent and rapid action in terms of fossil fuel phase out, who knows? A lot of countries have a lot of money in fossil fuels, and honestly, it's it's what keeps the world go round right now. So it's going to take quite a big change and quite a lot of commitment by countries to fully phase out and decarbonize. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Dr. Patz, you know, we've seen OPEC accusing the International Energy Agency of vilifying the oil and gas industry. And just wondering, do these divisions hurt progress at the summit, or how to talk about and address the reduction and elimination of fossil fuels?
Yes, yes, of course, there are vested interests in this. There are going to be some winners and losers. But I think we're at a junction where progress can really be made. You know, my colleague Greg Nemet is famous for showing how rapid the price of solar energy has fallen. It's fallen 300-fold in the last 40 years. So, you know, instead of thinking about switching, getting off of fossil fuels and making sacrifices, there really aren't sacrifices when renewable energy is so cheap now. And I know that there are a lot of wealthy countries, especially oil-based companies, countries that are investing more in solar. Qatar is making huge investments in renewable energy. So there's going to have to be a rapid transition. It's going to be harder for some countries than others. But I think that the writing is on the wall. I think the Inflation Reduction Act that the Biden administration passed puts a price signal and a signal for the economy. I think there are a lot of industries that are moving to low carbon energy. And, you know, we know that that's a huge gain, not only for clean energy jobs, which outnumber fossil fuel based jobs, but, you know, in NOVA and my area of the intersection of climate change and public health, we know that there are enormous gains, and gains for Wisconsin. You know, we've looked at studies looking at getting to clean energy and saving 2,000 lives in Wisconsin every year, equivalent of $21 billion in avoided mortality and hospital costs. So, you know, there are enormous opportunities here. I view climate action as potentially the greatest health opportunity of our lifetime. And I think things are beginning to align where the possibility to get to a low carbon economy really is possible.
NOVA, you have the last word here in our last 30 seconds or so. What is the most important action that could come out of this year's conference?
Yeah, I think personally that would be the global stock take, really identifying how we've done in terms of reaching our goal at the Paris Agreement. That's going to be vital, and seeing what the way forward and the guidance coming out of the global stock take will be and how prescriptive it'll be will be very important, not only for COP28, but also in future negotiations.
NOVA and Dr. Jonathan Patz, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Kate.
NOVA Tebbe is a doctoral student in UW-Madison's Environment and Resources Program studying how to make climate policies healthier and more equitable. Dr. Jonathan Patz was the inaugural director of UW-Madison's Global Health Institute, now a professor in the Nelson Institute at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.